You may be seated. For those of you who haven't been, who weren't here last week, or maybe haven't been a part of the past several weeks, like 8, 9 weeks we've been doing a series on the Old Testament. Last week we looked briefly at the book of Judges and saw what a wonderful period of time it was in the lives of the children of Israel. If you aren't familiar with the book of Judges, it was not a real great time. The children of Israel repeatedly would turn away from the one true God to worship idols, and then they would be taken into captivity by the nations surrounding them for periods of 10, 20, longer years. And then they would cry out to God because they were miserable and didn't like being in captivity. And then, oh yeah, there was this God that we once knew. And when they would cry out to him, God faithfully would raise up another person, a judge, that would do things and to help them be delivered again, and they would be thankful for a period of time, and then they would go right back to worshiping other gods and not remembering the true God, and then God would raise up a judge. It's like repeated over and over again. Tom is the one who taught it, and he summarized it. He said the summary of Judges is in Judges 17, verse 6. You can turn there if you want, or I'll read it. It says, "In those days there was no king in Israel, but every man did that which was right in his eyes." So that's the period that we just finished, you know, and Tom hinted at what we were going to get into this week. He must have asked me 3 times, do you think they guessed, jokingly? How many of you guessed what we were going to look at, the name of the person? Yes, we're going to look at the book of Ruth, and I wanted to thank Tom, particularly for his oversight and teaching in this fellowship that we get to be a part of. This Old Testament series has really bless my life immensely, and then also I want to thank him for the privilege I get of sharing God's word regarding Ruth with you this morning. So you can take your Bibles and turn to Matthew. We're going to go to Matthew chapter 1. I really am sharing on Ruth. The book of Ruth takes place during the book of Judges. So Judges was written, you know, these were all written, the book of Ruth they figure was written probably around David's time, looking back. Here's what went on. And God tells us all about this period of time with Judges. Then Ruth is here, just kind of an aside. And while this was going on, here's this. And it's like a breath of fresh air after reading Judges to look at Ruth and her loyalty and devotion to the one true God and to her mother-in-law, Naomi. And, you know, even in spite of her negative circumstances, how she chose to trust God is so refreshing, because you look at the children of Israel time and time again not doing that. So it's a real real testimony to this woman's faithfulness in trusting God. About a year ago, I think it was January of 2014, Robert Mullins did a wonderful teaching covering every verse of the book of Ruth, and I'd recommend listening to that if you know, we're not going to read every verse today, but it thoroughly covers the detail. But we thought it still would be good to look at Ruth now that you're in the middle of seeing this, how it fits in here. So in Matthew chapter 1, we're going to start in verse 1. It says, "The book of the generation of Jesus Christ." So this is telling us about the genealogy of Jesus Christ, okay? "The son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham begot Isaac, and Isaac begot Jacob. Jacob begat Judas and his brethren, and Judas begat Phares and Zerah of Thamar, and Phares begat Esrom, and Esrom begat Aram," and I may not be saying these all right, but, "and Aram begat Abinadab, and Abinadab begat Nahson, and Nahson begat Salmon," or Salmon is how I would say it, from the West Coast. It's probably not. And anyway, he begat, it says Booz, if you look in like in other translations, it's Boaz. Of Rahab is who the Rachab is in King James. And Boaz begat Obed of Ruth. There she is. That's why I wanted to look at it. In case you didn't know, she's listed in the genealogy of Jesus Christ. There are four women that are listed in the genealogy of Jesus Christ. One is Mary, who's his mother. She ought to be in there. But then there's 3 others that are. Ruth is one of those. Most of the time, that's not how that culture and how God listed the genealogies. It was usually of the male in the genealogy, but she's listed in here, and I think you'll see as we look at the book of Ruth why. So if you want to turn to the book of Ruth now, we are going there. (Clears throat) In Ruth chapter 1, we'll start. In verse 1, it says, "Now it came to pass," I'll give you a minute to find it, some of you. It's right after where we were last week, Judges, that helps. "Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled," so see, this is why we know it took place at that time. I'm pretty smart, and I researched it for years. No. But God has a reason for telling us that too. I think you'll see how delightful, how refreshing it is to look at someone who chose to trust God in the midst of that kind of surrounding and stuff. It says that, anyway, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. If you want to look back to Judges chapter 6, I think it is. Yeah. Some scholars believe this is the famine. Other scholars don't, but I thought I would look at it. Just for me, it helped me visualize. I mean, how many of you have ever lived through a famine? It's just not something we see. There's always something in the... I mean, maybe when there's a snowstorm, you go to get something at the grocery store and they're out. But other than that, you know, there's always something else you could replace it with. We don't live in times of famine like they did. Technology and different things have taken over that, you know. But in chapter 6 and verse 1, it says, "And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord." That phrase, or "the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord," is used 15 times in the book of Judges. It's something that's reoccurring. "And the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel. And because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made them dens which are in the mountains and caves and strongholds, hiding out from them. And so it was when Israel had sown that the Midianites came up, and the Amalekites and the children of the east, even they came up against them. And they encamped against them and destroyed the increase of the earth till thou come unto Gaza, and left no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor ass. For they came up with their cattle and their tents, and they came as grasshoppers for multitude, for both they and their camels were without number, and they entered into the land to destroy it. And Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried unto the Lord." You know, Ruth, the book of Ruth doesn't tell us that was the famine, but that's what we're talking about when we read the word famine, which you know that word, but the idea that everything that you could possibly use to sustain yourself being destroyed is kind of beyond what we've ever, you know, we don't experience that. And so here's this man we're going to read about here. Because of this famine, it says, "And a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. And the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the name of his two sons Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they came into the country of Moab and continued there." You know, it was a bad time for the children of Israel at that time. Now, they brought it on themselves, obviously, by doing evil and turning away from the true God, and disaster resulted. But, you know, Elimelech, in order to take care of his family, decides he needs to leave to provide for his family. There's no food. There's not even food for the cattle. There's nothing there. So he chooses to leave the land and go to Moab, which was enemy territory. Moab, not a good thing in the Bible if you read about it. Wasn't one of the nations that really supported the children of Israel at all. There's a section in even in Judges where they, have the children of Israel captive for like 18 years, and then God delivers them again. So, they're an enemy of God's, and that's where Elimelech chooses to go to be able to take care of his family. It's a testimony of where the children of Israel were at that time. That, you know, God had promised this land to his people. He had promised to take care of them in that land. And Elimelech obviously didn't trust that that was going to happen. So he figured out his own way to take care of his family. Now, Ruth doesn't magnify that point. It also doesn't say God told him to go to Moab. So, you know, just from what we know of Scripture, it probably wasn't a good idea for him to go unless the Lord had directed him to go. In order for him to leave that land, it doesn't say what he did with it. Many times you could, there's a lot of rules and regulations about the promised land that God gave them. You were allowed to sell your property if you were too poor to take care of it to someone with, you know, one of the children, not to a Moabite, to the children of Israel, to someone in your tribe. You could sell it to them. There were other rules that took place here. He might have forfeited his right to do anything with the land for the years that he was gone. He might have sold it to, you know, a relative or something. It doesn't really say what he did with it. But we know he was in Moab, as we'll read on, for more than 10 years. So it probably just didn't sit dormant, I would imagine. He probably did sell it, maybe sold it to get the money to take his family there, to have some way of getting him there. But we know that, you know, it does indicate a lack of trust in the one true God, which wasn't a surprising thing at this time and period with the children of Israel. Let's read on. In verse 3 it says, "And Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. And they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpha, and the name of the other Ruth, and they dwelled there about 10 years. Now, was that a good thing for the children of Israel to marry into other nations? No, we've been looking at the Old Testament. That was definitely something they were not supposed to do. These sons did. I mean, I understand there weren't any other women there from their tribes, but still God had told them they shouldn't do that. In Deuteronomy 23, you don't have to turn there. There's a reference in verse 3. It says that an Ammonite or a Moabite, which those were both nations that came from Lot. After God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot's daughters decide that there's no way they can have a husband and have children. So they trick their father and they go in and they conceive children by their father. And their sons are the where we get the Ammonites and the Moabites from. And in Deuteronomy 23, verse 3, is where it says that a Moabite, an Ammonite or a Moabite, shall not enter into the congregation of the children of Israel, even to the 10th generation. So probably not a good thing to marry them, you think? So what happens to them? And Mahlon and Chilion died both, also both of them. And the woman was left of her two sons and her husband. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab how that the Lord had visited his people and giving them bread. Oh, God delivered again. So she's going to go back to the land, you know, where the children of Israel are. And she says in verse 7, "Wherefore she went forth out of the place where she was, and her two daughter-in-laws with her. And they went on the way to return unto the land of Judah. And Naomi said unto her two daughters-in-law, Go, return each to her master's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant you that you may find rest each of you in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lift up their voice and wept. You know, as we'll read on, you know, this time period for women is not like it is today. I mean, when my father passed away, my mother, let's see, I'm going to sell the house. And, I mean, she had all these, you know, I hope she doesn't listen, no. She had these plans, and, you know, she bought property here, and she did this, and she came and visited people, and she flew all over the country and did a lot. Not that she was rejoicing. I'm just saying that she wasn't bound to, like they were in this time period. Naomi did have rights to the land because there was no one else in the family. The problem is that a woman wasn't allowed to do any negotiations. She wasn't allowed to speak to men except for when they asked for water, and I forget the other reason, something. Two reasons that a woman could talk to a man. So she pretty much has no resources at this point in time. She's lost her husband who would have taken care of her. She's lost the two sons who could have done the negotiating and taking care of her. And it's hard to relate in our culture because we do have rights that we can do things as women. And, you know, if you were to lose your spouse, I mean, yeah, you're not going to rejoice. You'll be sad, but you still have a means to take care of yourself. You can still work. You can still provide for yourself and for your family. That wasn't the case. And so she pretty much tells her daughter-in-laws, you might as well go back. I have nothing for you. you know, and you might as well go back to your own homes, to your own family, where they can take care of you, and maybe you'll meet another husband. And let's see, we left off in verse 9. In verse 10 it says, "And they said unto her, Surely we will return with thee unto thy people. And Naomi said, Turn again, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there yet any more sons in my womb that they may be your husbands?" Now that's a weird concept to you and I. But in the Bible lands and in the law, you can go back to Deuteronomy. We'll take a look. Keep your finger here if you want. I'll show you one of the things that the law took care of. And I wrote down the wrong reference, I think, here. Jeez. Let me just give me one second here. Oh, verse 5. Deuteronomy 25, verse 5. It says, "If brethren dwell together, and one of them die and have no child," which is where Naomi's at, right? She has daughters-in-law, but they don't have any children. "The wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger." She wasn't supposed to marry outside of her tribe. "Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him for, to wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her." I know these concepts seem maybe strange to you and I. Part of why things were set up the way they were is God had promised this land. It was divided, as we learned in Joshua, to specific tribes, to specific families within the tribes. There were all kinds of different laws, like if you were of this tribe, you weren't supposed to marry into another tribe. Well, you could, but if you did, your land would, you know, like if I were a woman and I married a guy from another tribe, that land, my land that I had rights to, would be forfeited. So they were encouraged to marry within the tribe. There are different rules like that. So that's here. You know, this land is promised to this tribe and the families that are a part of that tribe. If the guy dies, then the brother marries her to keep the land within that family, to keep what God had promised to that their progeny within that family. And there's other different places. There's lots of different things about it. We're not going to go through all that. But just for your understanding, this isn't a weird thing for her to say. You know, "Are there more sons in my womb that they could be your husbands?" You know, verse 12, "Turn again, my daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have a hope, if I should have a husband also tonight and also should also bear sons." You know, it appears and it seems like, she's too old to have kids. So it wouldn't even do any good if she married a brother, is what she's saying, you know. "And even if I could marry and have a son, are you going to wait till he grows up to marry him?" That's what the next verse says. Verse 13, "Would you tarry for them till they were grown? Would you stay for them, you know, for them from having husbands? Nay, my daughters, for it grieveth me much for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." You know, in that time and culture, for a woman to not have a husband, to not have children, to not particularly sons, you know, they believed that the hand of God was against them. Because they were so destitute, they had no way of taking care of themselves, really. So we'll read on here. "And they lift up their voice and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave unto her." So pretty much Orpah's saying, okay, see ya. That's a kissing is saying, and goodbye. But Ruth clings to her. Ruth wants to stay with her. And she said, "Behold, thy sister-in-law," Naomi says, "behold, thy sister-in-law has gone back unto her people and unto her gods. Return thou after thy sister-in-law." And Ruth says, the next few verses just stand just like a diamond here. "And Ruth said, entreat me not to leave thee or to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go. And where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people and thy God my God. Where thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me and more also, if aught but death part thee and me." You know, and like I said, for someone of our culture to read this, it's not doesn't seem that big of a deal. Oh, she loved her mother-in-law and wants to go with her. But it was a huge commitment for her to be willing to be destitute, to willing to go through having, you know, the things that Naomi was going through, and to not have anything, to leave her own family, to leave her own gods, the things that she was familiar with, to just take off and go with her, is a huge deal. Like I said, for me to go stay with my mother-in-law, if she were still alive, not a big deal. It really isn't. But for this time period, in this culture, it's a huge commitment. And you also see in this verse, though, she isn't just doing it for Naomi, she's doing it, why? For God. You know, I'll serve your God. We know she was a Moabite. We know that she was married to those sons. She was a part of that family. She'd learned about the true God somewhere here, because that's, she wants to go and serve the true God. I mean, how many of you, once you've heard about the true God, want to go back to the old stuff? You know, how much more blatant would this be in a culture where, I mean, they worship the fish god, for goodness sakes, in Moab. And, you know, the things that went along with the worship of idols and that, you know, it was just such a stark contrast to the goodness and the greatness of the true God. Where do we leave off? 17? We'll read on here. When she saw that she was steadfastly minded to go with her, then she left speaking unto her. So they too went until they came to Bethlehem. And it came to pass, when they were come to Bethlehem, that all the city was moved about them. And they said, "Is this Naomi?" And she said, they were excited. Hey, Naomi's back, you know. And she said unto them, "Call me not Naomi, call me Mara. For the Almighty hath dealt very bitterly with me," which is what Mara means. And this is where she's at. You know, she is not a happy woman at this point in time. Are God's promises still true to her? Yeah, but at this point in time, she's magnifying what the horrible thing. She's lost her husband. She's lost her sons. That is a horrible thing to go through, if you've ever been in that situation. To lose one person you love is a hard thing to get over. But she's lost three. And in this time period, like we said, once again, it's what that indicates for her posterity, for her, you know, for what's to come in her life, is not looking real good. Chapter 2. Did we finish chapter 1? We did, right? No? Okay. "I went out full, and the Lord hath brought me home again empty. Why then call ye me Naomi, seeing that the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty hath afflicted me?" So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, which returned out of the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem in the beginning of barley harvest. Those of you men studying the feast, what's a barley harvest? What time is it? Passover. Maybe those of you who aren't studying the feast know that too. So it's about the time of the Passover when they get back there. In verse 2, chapter 2, verse 1, it says, "And Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth of the family of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz." This is like an aside to what's going on. By the way, she has this relative who's rich, and his name's Boaz. It's not that she's thinking about him at this point in time. As we read on, you'll see. But she does have a relative, Boaz. In verse 2, "And Ruth the Moabitess said unto Naomi, let me now go to the field and glean ears of corn after him in whose sight I shall find grace. And she said unto her, go, my daughter." Take your Bibles and turn to Deuteronomy chapter 24. She asked Naomi, they're poor, they have no way of taking care of themselves. So she asks, you know, I'm going to go glean in the field and maybe I'll find favor with the guys whose field it is. In chapter 24, she's not hoping to just go to a field and steal some things. This is part of the law and part of the provision in the law for them to take care of the poor and the widows. And one other thing I forget. Deuteronomy 24, verse 19. This is in the law, and it says, verse 19, "When thou cuttest down thine harvest in the field, and hast forgot a sheaf in the field, thou shalt not go again to fetch it, for it shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow, that the Lord thy God may bless thee in all the work of thine hands. When thou beatest thine olive tree, thou shalt not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow. When thou gatherest the grapes of thy vineyard, thou shalt not glean it afterwards. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and the widow. So this was in the law. If you want to look at Leviticus as well, it talks about it there too, chapter 19, that when they were harvesting things, they weren't to just strip it bare, and if they missed something, to go back and get every little bit. They were supposed to leave some for the fatherless, for the stranger, for the widow. Leviticus talks about for the poor as well, which the fatherless and the widow probably would be a lot of those. Leviticus 19, in verse 9, it says, "And when you reap the harvest of your land, thou shalt not wholly reap the corners of thy field, neither shalt thou gather the gleanings of thy harvest." What's left over there. "And thou shalt not glean thy vineyard, neither shalt thou gather every grape of thy vineyard. Thou shalt leave them for the poor and stranger. I am the Lord your God." So Ruth here is asking her mother-in-law, "Can I go glean in the fields? And perhaps someone will find favor with me." So it was something that you were allowed to do. That was written in the law, and it was a common custom. The freedom to glean behind the reapers was not written there. To go right behind him. And that's kind of the favor she's kind of looking for, that I could go and glean right behind him so I can get enough to take care of us. That right was given to them by the owner of the field. He could grant that privilege to them. I'm going to just summarize the next few verses just for time's sake, because we could be here quite a while. In verses 4 through 10, Boaz sees Ruth gleaning in the field. Oh, that's the cool thing. She happens to go to glean in a field, and it just happens to be Boaz's field. Just happens. That's how it's worded in the word, too. It's kind of delightful. She just happens to go to this field, and it happens to be his. And so Boaz sees Ruth gleaning behind the reapers and asks them, "Who is this woman?" And they tell her it's the Moabitess that came back with Naomi. And Boaz tells Ruth that she doesn't need to glean in any other field but his. And he offers her protection, shelter in the heat of the day. She's allowed to go in this. They had little tents or canopies in the fields where the workers would take a break in the heat of the day. I visited that area of the country. I'd be in the tent the whole time with an air conditioner blowing if I could. It's hot there. You couldn't work in the heat of the day there. It's just intense. We could hardly walk in it in the middle of the day. It's just really, really hot. So they had these little shelters where they could go. And they would rest. And he told her, "You can go in there with my workers and rest. And you can drink with them, have water from them." Later on, he offers her to have food and stuff too as well. And then he also tells the workers, leave extra, you know. Throw some extra down for her. He goes out of his way to care for her. And Ruth asks why he's extending this grace to a total stranger. And he tells her, we'll look at it in verse 11, chapter 2, verse 11. And he responds to her, "And Boaz answered and said unto her, It hath fully been showed me all that thou hast done unto thy mother-in-law since the death of thine husband, and how thou hast left thy father and thy mother in the land of thy nativity, and art come unto a people which thou knewest not heretofore. The Lord recompense thy work, and a full reward be given thee of the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings thou art come to trust." You know, once again, we see her trust in God. It's not just that she had this devotion and love for Naomi, which I'm sure she did, but she also trusted in the living God. The rest of the verses 13 through 19, Ruth ends up being invited to come and eat with the reapers and with Boaz. That's where he instructs his servants to leave extra in the fields for her to glean. And then Ruth goes back to Naomi and shows her what she has gleaned that day. And Naomi asks her where she gleaned, because it is so much. She comes home with all this, which is not normal for gleaning in the fields. "Where'd you go? This is like, whoa, we've got to go back there." Verse 20. "And Naomi said unto her daughter-in-law, Blessed be he of the Lord, who hath not left off his kindness to the living and to the dead." Naomi sees the hand of God working for her. It's a beautiful testimony. And it's through this little woman, Ruth, who decides, well, I'm going to go glean and I'm going to go here. And look what God does. And Naomi sees that the hand of God is still there to take care of her. It's a beautiful testimony. And Naomi said unto her, the man is near of kin unto us, one of our next kinsmen. She tells Ruth that, you know, he's a close relation, close relative of theirs. In fact, that word next kinsman is, it's a combination of redeemer. I mean, he's telling her he's eligible to be one that could do more for us, as we're going to see. One that could be qualified to be what the Bible refers to as a kinsman redeemer. That's where the brother could bury the wife, and he would redeem the land and redeem her. Remember, we talked about that. And she says that Boaz is one who could do that. There's other things a kinsman redeemer could do as well. They could redeem the land of their relative in Leviticus 25, verse 25. I'm going to read it in the NIV. It's kind of clear. It says, if one of your fellow Israelites becomes poor and sells some of their property, their nearest relative is to come and redeem what they have sold. One of the neat things, though, about the land that I've learned as we were looking at the feasts is that every 50 years with the children of Israel, there would be what was called the Year of Jubilee. And even if you sold your land, it would be possible for you to get it back, to pay off the debt, to have it back, come back to your family. So every 50 years, that was going to be available. But who knows when the Year of Jubilee was for Naomi. Maybe it was 49 years away. I don't know. But at this point in time, anyways. A kinsman redeemer could marry the widow of the deceased relative to provide for them and to keep the land in the same family or tribe. And if you want to read more about that, Deuteronomy 25 is a great place to look at that. You know, you had to be qualified in order to be the kinsman redeemer. You couldn't be the 10th cousin of somebody to do it. You had to be a close relative. You had to be one that could do it. The closest relative is the one that would be first could do it. You had to have the resources to do it. Because if the land had been sold and worked for so many years, there was a debt to be paid to buy the land back. You couldn't just say, I'm the relative, I'm taking it. You had to, you know, do what was right and proper. And that, in order to do that, you had to have the means to do that. Not everybody did. We know that Boaz was a wealthy man, though, right? And you had to do it exactly according to the law. Let's go to chapter 3. So chapter 2 ended up with her finding out it's Boaz's field and that this guy Boaz could be a kinsman redeemer for them. Chapter 3, verse 1. Oh, I know, I wanted to mention one other thing. It says in verse 23. So Ruth, so she kept fast by the maidens of Boaz to glean unto the end of barley harvest and of wheat harvest, and dealt with her mother-in-law. So we have barley harvest, which is Passover. So she gleans all during that time. And then when is the wheat harvest? Pentecost, and that's how many weeks after the end of 7 weeks. So we know she didn't just glean for a day or two. She did it probably for a period of 2 or 3 months. She went out to the field daily and worked hard gleaning in his field. And he gave her those things all that time, which is really sweet. Anyway, chapter 3. Verse 1. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said unto her, my daughter, shall I not seek rest for thee, that it may be well with thee? Naomi's concerned about Ruth. You know, okay, the harvest has just ended. I mean, you know, we got to provide for ourselves. She's concerned about her. And she tells her what to do in the following verses. And I'm not going to read all of these once again. So I'll kind of summarize most of the rest of the chapter. She tells her to go to the threshing floor that night where Boaz will be working. And that after he lies down, she's to uncover his feet and lie down on his feet, and that he would tell her what to do. That seems very strange to us. There's some of the commentaries are horrible in what they have to say about this, that this, she has her get all dressed up and has her bathe and put on the perfumes, and she goes to seduce him. So he has to marry her. That's not it at all. If you know the lands and times of the Bible and the customs and the law, what she's doing is okay. Women didn't generally go to the threshing floor. Normally a man might go there to negotiate for the family. Would you marry this woman? But because they have no man to do that, this is what Naomi instructs her to do. It's very proper. Nothing sexual takes place while she's there. That's not the point of it. It's that Naomi wants to take care of her, and she tells her what to do. And little Ruth just does everything. Little Ruth, I don't know how she's little. Maybe she was 6 feet tall. Maybe she, I don't know. But anyway, she does exactly what the woman tells her to do. And she says that Boaz would tell her what to do then. Boaz tells her that he's willing to be her kinsman redeemer, but that there is one relative that is closer than him, and he has to go check with him first. So he tells her to stay there for the night at his feet. He covers her with his mantle, which is an indicator that he's offering her his protection. That's another reason we know nothing went on that was improper, because of his commitment to her, that I will take care of, and he calls her daughter, and I will take care of, there's a care there for her life, and an honor there for who she represents, and who she, you know, what she did for Naomi. So he tells her to lay down until the morning, and early in the morning, she gets up, and he sends her back to Naomi with a bunch of grain again. Of course, he says, here's a bunch. And so she goes back to Naomi and reports into her and tells her what went on. Let's go to chapter 4. That's briefly what went on. You can read it yourself. Like I said, I don't want to take all day reading every verse, because there's some points I want to make that I want to make sure we get to. In chapter 4, in verse 1, it says, then Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the kinsman of whom Boaz spake came by. I love how these things just kind of happen, you know. She just happened to glean in the field of Boaz, and this kinsman just happens to come by. And the kinsman of whom Boaz spake came by, and to whom he said, oh, such a one, come on, turn aside, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit ye down here. And they sat down. The gate of the city is where a lot of business transpired. You had to have witnesses to that. The ten elders are witnesses of what's going to transpire, and that's why he asked them to sit down. And we'll read on here. And he said unto the kinsman, Naomi, that has come out of the country of Moab, selleth a parcel of land, which was our brother Elimelech's. And I thought to advertise thee, saying, buy it before the inhabitants and before the elders of my people. If thou wilt redeem it, redeem it. But if thou wilt not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is none to redeem it besides thee, and I am after thee. So you understand the order there. This guy was the closest relative. Boaz is next. So do you want to redeem it? If you don't, I'm going to. And he said, I will redeem it. Then said Boaz, what day thou buyest the field of the hand of Naomi, thou must buy it also of Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance. In other words, if the kinsman was going to be the redeemer, he also would take care of Naomi. He also would need to marry Ruth to give her a son. Since Naomi couldn't have a son, he was, you know, responsible to marry her and endeavor to give her a son, so the land would stay in that family. And the guy says, whoa, wait a minute here. I don't know if I want to do that. That's what he says, basically. He says, and the kinsman said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I mar mine own inheritance. Redeem thou my right to thyself, for I cannot redeem it. Doesn't say why it would mar his inheritance. He might have already been married and had children. And then he's not only taking on the financial responsibility of that land, but also of Naomi, also of Ruth and any children they might have together. And there would be no benefit of the land to his family because it would all stay in her family. Do you understand? So it's a lot bigger thing than he's taken on in doing this. And he says, no, I don't want to do it. So he refuses to do it. And where did we leave off here? 7. Now this was the manner in former time in Israel concerning redeeming and concerning changing. For to confirm all things, a man plucked off his shoe and gave it to his neighbor. And this was a testimony in Israel. There's a section in the word that talks about when the widow goes to the kinsman and says, will you redeem it? And he won't, or however it happens. And she takes off his shoe and spits in his face because he won't. You know, so... And then, you know, hereafter he'll be known as the one who wouldn't, you know, who plucked off the shoe, whatever. So that was, to me, it's funny, you know. You know, there's other things where you spit in the hand, you rub it together. And people have ways, and, you know, before we had all the legal stuff we have, that was their legal way. He, the kinsman that could have redeemed it, took off his shoe and gave it to him as an indicator, no, you now have that right. Did he give him his shoe back when they were done? I don't know. Probably. Probably no one else thought of that, but they'd lose a lot of shoes, though, in these dealings. And Boaz said unto the elders and to all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's of the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, have I purchased to be my wife, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance, that the name of the dead be not cut off from among his brethren and from the gate of his place. You are witnesses this day. And all the people that were in the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. The Lord make the woman that is come into thine house like Rachel and like Leah, which two did build the house of Israel. And do thou worthily in Ephrathah, I don't know how to say it, and be famous in Bethlehem. And let thy house be like the house of Phares, whom Tamar bare. Tamar is also in the line of Christ too. Bare Judah, and of the seed which the Lord shall give thee of the young woman. So Boaz took Ruth, and she was his wife. And when he went in unto her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bare a son. And the woman said unto Naomi, and the women said unto Naomi, blessed be the Lord, which hath not left thee this day without a kinsman, that his name may be famous in Israel. And he shall be unto thee a restorer of thy life, and a nourisher of thine old age. For thy daughter-in-law, which loveth thee, which is better to thee than seven sons, hath borne him. That's what I mean. You read things like that, and it's obviously beyond our culture and understanding what a big deal it was. She's better to you than seven sons is a huge thing to say, you know? And Naomi took the child and laid it in her bosom and became nurse unto it. And the women, her neighbors, gave it a name, saying, there is a son born to Naomi, and they call his name Obed. Isn't that funny how they do that, though? But it was an indicator, you know, she was, you know, this was her grandchild, and there was an honor given to her for her daughter-in-law having the baby. It's something that would be, you know, it'd be like, you know, you guys think, whoa, you're so great when one of my kids has a kid. It's like, you don't. You talk to the mom and you get her presents. You don't. But in this culture, that's not how it was done. It was an indicator here. There is a son born to Naomi, and they called his name Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now, these are the generations of Phares. Phares begot Hezron. And Hezron begat Ram, and Ram begot Amminadab. And Amminadab begot Nahshon, and Nahshon begot Salmon. And Salmon begot Boaz, and Boaz begat Obed. And Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begot David. So, you know, Ruth's devotion and allegiance just are a sterling example of trusting God despite the circumstances around it, you know, around her. And of course, you know, she did choose to go with Naomi and trust God because she knew she was going to be in the, you know, she was going to give birth to someone that was going to be in the Christ line, right? No. I mean, sometimes we want to have the answers before we trust God. But, you know, what an example of trusting God, of just undivided allegiance to God and to Naomi. To trust in the living God that he would be faithful. And look how faithful God was. And time again, that's what we see in the Old Testament. In spite of people, God is so faithful. You know, and he tells us that in our time too, that he's faithful to us. He's faithful to see things come to pass in our lives that he's promised, you know. We may not always know the specific outcome of devotion in our lives and loyalty to God in our lives for, you know, the outcome of trusting him, what it's going to bring to our life. But we know the God who's promised things, and we can trust in him. You know, that he will take care of his own, just like he did here in the Old Testament. He's faithful to do that. And as we read records like that, it's a great example to us that, yeah, I may not know the benefit of trusting my God, but look at how he comes through time and time again when I will choose to put my heart before him, to trust him with everything I have, to choose to not get caught up in the circumstances in my life, to trust in, you know, something else. You know, one of the places in the New Testament that talk about how faithful God is, it also, the next verse talks about, so don't turn to idols. And that spoke so loudly to me when I was looking at that, you know, that it's so easy to let circumstances cause us to turn away from God, but we can choose to be ones like Ruth, who choose to turn to the living God, despite our circumstances, to trust him in any situation, to wait on him to come through time and time again. Because our God is faithful. And I ended up early. I could have read all the verses, I guess, like Robert did, but... Someone want to let Children's Fellowship know we're done a little bit early? I think they like us to wait, don't they, before picking them up? Anybody know? Yeah. Till when? Around noon. We get more time for coffee and fellowship and to exhort one another with God's word. So Mike and Sherry, what are we going to close with?
We're going to close with number 30, God will take care of you.
Oh, before we do, next week... We're taking a Sunday off from the Old Testament. The following week, if you want to get ahead on your reading, you could start reading 1 Samuel chapters 1 through 15. Okay? God bless you all. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy. Number 30, God will take care of you. We're just going to sing the first and third verses of this one, okay?
Bless you.